Hey, Kingdom Roots listeners, got that special opportunity for you that I promised last time for you, our listeners, to receive a copy of Scott's new book. This time, the new book that's coming out called Adam and the Genome. Now, all you have to do again is share your favorite line from today's podcast with the hashtag Kingdom Roots on Twitter or Facebook, and we will put you into a drawing to win a copy of Scott's new book. Now, we're going to do the drawing on February 1st, so make sure to share your favorite line before then if you want a chance to win a copy of Adam and the Genome that comes out soon. We look forward to hearing from you and what your favorite line from our episode is.
Welcome to the Kingdom Roots podcast with Scott McKnight, the conversation designed to look at how the kingdom took root then and how it's taking root now. Today on the podcast, we have a conversation about Adam and the Genome. It's a new book coming out by Dennis Venema and Scott McKnight. So Scott, you and Dennis have been working on this new book, Adam and the Genome, and it, from what I understand, kind of looks at the recent research and discovery with the genome and evolutionary processes and how that can and needs to really affect how we look at scripture and specifically really, I guess, the creation of the world. So I guess just to start off, why is it important to be having this discussion?
Chaz, for 17 years in my life, I taught college students. And every fall, when I taught at North Park University, I taught the honors introduction to the Bible class, in which class anywhere from 3 to 10 of my students would be science majors. And I saw into their soul. And I saw pain. I saw worry. I saw doubt. I saw in them a wondering, can I be a scientist and be a Christian? Can I be a scientist and believe in the Bible? I'll never forget the day a student came up to me. I had been lecturing on Genesis 1 and 2, and John Walton from Wheaton College had just come out with his book, The Lost World of Genesis 1 and 2, I think it's called, or The Lost World of Genesis 1, in which he proposes some theses on how to understand Genesis 1, a little bit complex. He gets into what he calls functional ontology rather than material ontology, that the point of these chapters is about the function of these items in the overall work of God rather than their specific origin. John is a conservative. Even on Adam and Eve, he's conservative. But at the same time, he proposes a model for understanding Genesis 1 and 2 in the historical context of the ancient Near East. And the science student came up to me with tears running down his face. This was a really smart kid. And he says to me, and I got to know him over time, he said to me, "You saved my faith today." And we had a conversation in which he told me, he said that his pastor was a young earth creationist who maybe thought intelligent design was permissible, but no more than that. And he said he basically had convinced me that if I didn't believe in young earth creationism, that I might as well just give up on Christianity because the whole Bible would be false then. And he said, "But what you said today has saved my faith because I realized that his interpretation of Genesis 1 may not be the right interpretation of the text, even though the theology that is being used by that pastor is a theology rooted in a very specific interpretation of Genesis chapter 1. So let me just say why we need to study this is because there are many people in our churches who are scientific types, who believe in evidence, and who have come to the conviction that the earth is a whole lot, I always get these things mixed up, but I think it's the universe that's 13.6 billion years old or something like this. Mm-hmm. And they study this on the basis of expansion. And that, they've come to certain conclusions and then they look at Genesis 1 and 2 and they just kind of shake their head. So let me just say it's because of scientist types. But when I was a college student, When I first encountered some ideas about evolution or theistic evolution, what could now be called, I guess, in some ways, intelligent design. And I was an inductivist, an inductionist when it came to studying the Bible. I believed in looking at the evidence. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at some of this evidence, I thought, boy, the earth is a whole, the world, the universe is a whole lot older than what I was taught as a kid in Sunday school and in my church. And then when I was in seminary, I read a book by a guy named, I think his name was Dennis Thurman. And he distinguishes microevolution versus macroevolution. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the first time when I began to embrace evolution. And I have to confess something. When I began teaching at North Park University, I would look at Genesis 1 and 2, and I really wondered, how do I put this together with science? And I would give the theories and then move on and hope that no one pressed me too hard. And people didn't press me too hard. So I survived. But it was in reading John Walton that I said, I've got to get more involved in this conversation. And about that time, I became aware through my co-blogger, Roseanne Senshin, who is a scientist. I became aware of some other literature like Owen Gingerich and Francis Collins and a guy named Nelson who teaches at Pepperdine some, who's written a book on evolution, a history. He's written on the Scopes trial. And so I began to read about this. And then it was an article in a magazine written by Dennis Venema that was just overwhelmingly compelling to me as I read it. Here was a major conclusion. This is a major conclusion, Chaz, of the genome project. And that is that the DNA that is currently existing in human beings in the world today could not have come from anything less than a population of hominids or hominins of 10,000 approximately. So that the idea that we all came from two single individuals is extremely problematic for the genome project. Now, there's a couple ways of looking at this.
Yeah.
And this has been sort of the way Christians have approached science. Now, you have something you wanted to ask?
Yeah, you know, well, I guess before we get on to those two things, why do you feel like, and this is clearly such a divisive conversation, and it seems like, especially maybe you could categorize the fundamentalist camp, or maybe not even that, just young earth creationists are so unwilling to look at other evidence and, you know, be challenged by that and have to deal with that. Why do you think that is? Or why do you think that, has such a strong foothold, I guess?
Yeah, I think they think the whole thing collapses. The gospel is dependent upon a particular reading of Genesis 1 to 2. And I would say this, the way they read that would make the genome project a very serious threat. And I can understand why they think they have to junk it. They either say, I think the two basic approaches have been science is right and therefore we have to reread the Bible, mm-hmm. or the Bible's right and therefore we have to reread science.
Right. Yeah.
And scientists, I want to emphasize in my because of my students, I became very sensitive to scientific students, and I wanted to learn to speak into that context. So I have developed a sensitivity. When they start saying things that scientists say, that's wrong, I'm going to listen to them. But I think that, you know, either the Bible's wrong or science is wrong is a fundamental mistake in its approach.
So do you think there's a third way?
I think, yeah, there's about 80 ways, I suppose. I don't know them all. But yes, I think a third way is to say this. Maybe like Augustine, who said at one point something like this, if our reading of the Bible is contrary to science, maybe we ought to rethink the way we're reading the Bible. So I believe that the young earth creationists are misreading the Bible. They're misreading the Bible for two reasons. One is, I don't think they understand what that text meant in the ancient Near Eastern world. This is where John Walton, where Tremper Longman, where Pete End's work comes into play that needs to be listened to. And that is, when you look at John Walton, he says, what would this text have meant in that world? It would not mean what we would like it to mean in our scientific world, mm-hmm. is that it is, in that sense, it's theological. It's a presentation of truths about God. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the Bible's true. Every word of it's true. But I don't believe saying that the Bible's true locks us into a young earth creationist interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2, though I respect my friends who believe that. I respect their view of the Bible, mm-hmm. even if I disagree with their interpretation of the Bible. So I would want to urge us to recognize, here's what's happened to me. I realized that if there's evolutionary truths about evolution science, that the universe is a certain number of years old, that humans did not come from two people, I realized through that process that I need to be more sensitive to the ancient Near East. It wasn't science that made me reread the Bible. Mm-hmm. It was science that made me alert to listening to other voices when it comes to understanding what the Bible says. So I developed in my half this book, Adam and the Genome, that Dennis and I have written, and it should be out in the next couple of weeks. Dennis writes the first half of the book, sort of an introduction to evolutionary science based upon the Human Genome Project. And this comes out of a project connected to BioLogos, which I want to emphasize comes from the leadership of Francis Collins, the director of the National Institute of Health. You could say he's the number one scientist in the United States, from Tim Keller, who's the pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Manhattan, and at that time with Carl Giberson, who was a professor of science. Carl, so far as I know, is not so much involved in BioLogos anymore. And then it's moved to the Harsmas in Calvin, or in Grand Rapids. Deb Harsma is a scientist. And so the BioLogos invited me to be a part of what they were doing. I'll never forget giving a paper one night. Tim Keller gave a paper, then I gave a paper, then Tom Wright gave a paper. And I thought, this is a pretty heady group of people. In the audience was people like Oz Guinness and Alistair McGrath. And it was a very serious engagement over three or four days of discussing with theology people and science people how to talk about science in churches today. These people care about Christians. They care about students, and they care about science, and they care about the Bible. And this dialogue has been life-transforming for me. Well, as a result of that, Dennis approached me and asked if we'd like to apply for a grant from BioLogos to work on a book that we tentatively called Adam and the Genome, and that's what the book ended up being called. And Dennis writes the first half of the book on science, and the second half of the book, I develop an introduction to how to read the Bible respectfully. I develop a model of what historical Adam means. I look at what Genesis 1 and 2, basically, what, you know, mostly Genesis 1 and 2, what it says about Adam and Eve. And then I look at how Adam and Eve were understood in the Jewish world. So I have a long chapter that probably gets more involved than most people want to get involved with, but I think the details have to work out. And I was greatly helped by the exceptional work by Jack Levison, who's at Perkins in Dallas. And then I look at what the Apostle Paul means about Adam, in especially in Romans chapter 5, verses 12 through 21. So our book project is about Adam and the Genome Project. In a sense, how do we read the Bible after the Genome Project? But I want to emphasize that it's to me, it's not that science proved the Bible wrong, so now I want to reinterpret the Bible. I don't believe that. And I don't think that the Bible forces us to choose like that. I don't think that Christianity forces us to choose like that. Rather, it was my listening to science that made me say, you know, maybe we've used the Bible for scientific information when the Bible never intended to be used for scientific information. So that the result for me was I became convinced that I was reading the Bible wrong. I needed to read the Bible differently. And it took me a while. I'm not a specialist in the Old Testament. I don't spend a lot of time doing that. But I sat down and I read a bunch of these ancient Near Eastern texts, Gilgamesh epic and stuff like this. I looked at this stuff and I wanted to see what we could learn about Adam and Eve, Atrahasis and texts like that. I wanted to see what was going on in the Bible in its world and how that message in Genesis 1, 2, and 3 would have been heard in that world. So that's the sort of thing that we do in the book.
Yeah, that's good. So, Scott, I wonder if there's anything else, and you talked about so far about how, in this instance, science was for you an indication that maybe there is a more accurate way to read, particularly the creation account. In your life and in your study, have there been any other, disciplines is the right word, but any other things that have shed light on your having a particular reading of the text and then realizing that maybe there is a more accurate way to go about this?
Clearly the world of history, mm-hmm. the worlds of archaeology can really upset how some people understand things like Joshua or understand the Davidic kingdom. The world of history opens up our eyes to all kinds of facts that are going on at work in the world that suddenly reshape what we see going on in the New Testament. For instance, issues on same-sex relations. Once you read what the Greco-Roman world was like on sexuality, all of a sudden you look at the New Testament and you go, wow, this is a big issue. This is the New Testament setting itself over against the common practices of Greek and Roman males. And that's why a guy like William Loder, there's a new book out on sort of four views of homosexuality, edited by Preston Sprinkle. And the work by William Loder, who's written five or six books on this topic, and some of them very academic monographs on narrow topics, say, same-sex relations or sexuality in Philo of Alexandria. Once you realize that, then all of a sudden the New Testament takes on different hues and different angles. And so, yes, I've learned to think again about how I've read the Bible over and over and over in light of learning about the ancient world. So that's been a big part of it. Now, one of the things that I want to talk about that is a part of the book is, when it gets down to it, here's what happens. People say, well, Paul believed in the historical Adam. Jesus believed in the historical Adam. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we have to believe in the historical Adam. And they make all kinds of leaps. Mm-hmm. So what I did at the end of my first chapter in this book was sort of map out what we mean when we start talking about the historical Adam. All right, so I developed these seven ideas that there were two actual, or sometimes only two persons named Adam and Eve, who existed suddenly as a result of God's creation. That's one idea that's connected to historical Adam. A second is that those two persons have a biological relationship to all human beings and that are alive today. I call this biological Adam and Eve. That's a big issue. A third one is their DNA is our DNA. So now we have a genetic Adam and Eve. And that often means fourth, and this is where I think, this is why the young earth creationists, they both deserve to be listened to, and at the same time, they need to be understood for what they're saying. They believe that those two human beings, Adam and Eve, sinned, died, and brought death into the world. This is what I would call the fallen Adam and Eve. And if you don't, they would say, if you don't believe in that fallen Adam and Eve, then you have no reason for the gospel. Well, that's a big question we have to ask. A fifth is that those two Adam and Eves passed on their sin natures. and to all human beings. And I call this the sin nature, Adam and Eve. That without that sin nature being passed on from Adam and Eve to all their descendants, there would be no reason for redemption. A sixth one is, without their sinning and passing on that sin nature to all human beings, not all human beings would be in need of salvation. So now you have a need of salvation, Adam and Eve. And then finally, I think one of the common conclusions is, if one denies the historical Adam, which now we got to know what that means, one denies the gospel of salvation. Well, here's what I did. I think it's pretty obvious that Genesis 1 and 2 don't teach that. They don't teach it that way. So this is a construct that is that people think they get from Paul. What I did is I examined Adam and Eve and what Adam and Eve meant in the first century. I mean, in the Genesis 1 and 2 in the ancient Near East. But more importantly for my book is my section of the book, I develop how Jews understood Adam and Eve. And I think I can say this without any question, and I don't think that this is even disputable. There is no one in the world of Jesus and Paul, in the Jewish world that we know of, who believed that construct about Adam and Eve, that they are a biological, genetic DNA group of people who passed their sin nature onto other people, and therefore people are all in need of salvation. I think that the Jewish literature sets up Adam, and very rarely is Eve mentioned, so I call her his neglected partner. I think that what is common in the Jewish literature is that Adam is a paradigmatic figure of a person who is confronted by the will of God, who chooses to sin. So now in that Jewish context, now that's not the only Jewish context. There's at times that there seems to be a biological Adam and Eve at work, you know, that there were only two human beings, etc. Mm-hmm. That idea existed. But that doesn't mean that every Jew believed that, nor that Paul believed that. That's another thing. You have to see that Paul actually teaches that to say that he believed that. That all leads to an interpretation of Romans chapter 5 and what Paul meant when he used the word Adam. Did he mean this historical, biological, genetic Adam who passed on sin nature to other people and therefore in need of salvation? Does Paul say that Adam passed on his sin nature? What does Paul say? Paul says that that all sinned. He doesn't say that all sinned in Adam. He says that all sinned. This is a very important movement in Romans chapter 5, 12 through 21. So I examine that in that context, and I'm hoping that that we can have a fair and open conversation about what the Bible actually teaches about Adam and Eve. And I hope that we can have a fair and open conversation, especially for those who are scientific in our churches, about genetics, about the genome project, and about evolution. And I hope we can do this in a civil and governed manner, in a way that helps, that it respects the voice of others, and that just doesn't start clanging the cymbals and start accusing people of heresy or being mistaken. You know, I think that young earth creationists and intelligent design people, I think most of them are pretty sophisticated. I think most of them are articulate. I think most of them have their ideas put together pretty well. And I respect that. I disagree. In fact, at times I think they're seriously wrong about that. I expect them to think that of me. Mm-hmm. But I don't expect them to be accusing anybody who believes in evolution to be a heretic. We have to be extraordinarily respectful of one another on conversations like this, because the stakes for some people are so high that they start saying things about their brothers and sisters in Christ that while they think they're governing or at least protecting and teaching the truth, they may be simply wrong and fostering and foisting false ideas upon people who need to hear other options as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I feel like, you know, in the approach that you laid out, of the way to approach this whole conversation is understanding it in the context of it's about the faithfulness to the message of the Bible. And it's being willing to allow, you know, voices and observations and different understandings to lead us to a more faithful understanding of the message so that we can, you know, more faithfully follow the God that we believe has given us this message. And I think that's what, you know, John Walton does so well, of understanding really the main message and the importance of it, and how much of a bigger implication, I guess, that it has when we understand it, as you said, in the Near Eastern world. And yeah, I just think that that's so important for both sides to understand that, you know, it's about getting, and how do we be as faithful as we can be to this message?
You know, Chaz, I really, if I thought I was forcing the Bible into a grid, I would change my mind. Mm-hmm. But I found nothing less than liberation in baptizing Genesis 1 and 2 in the ancient Near East, and hearing things that I had never heard, reading things in books like John Walton's The Lost World, and he's got a beautiful academic book on this from Eisenbrown's. I found, when I read that, I thought, you know, this makes so much more sense to me. And then it was so encouraging to read in Augustine his comment that we need to be sensitive to science. And I wish more people realized that the historical Adam construct that many people use, which many people blame on Augustine, was the same guy who said we have to be sensitive to science. And I want to be sensitive to science because I want scientists in the church. But I, at the same time, yes, even when I disagree with, you know, I have former students who are intelligent design people who write me letters. I want to be respectful of them. I'm not going to just dismiss them and say, you know, they're a bunch of, you know, I don't even want to use words for the kinds of things that we say about one another. I don't think we need to be talking like that. I think we need to listen to one another, listen carefully to one another, so that we can help one another grow in our understanding and form a genuine dialogue about science and faith that will lead us forward. And, you know, Zondervan has a nice book on, I think it's four views on the historical Adam, or maybe five views. And I think those kinds of books are very helpful for students, because they'll say, you know, there's more than one view here. I need to listen to this conversation and come to a judgment based on the evidence as the way I see it. That's what I'm asking.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, to end our time together, any closing thoughts about Adam and the Genome?
Yeah, I hope people will buy this book. Not so that we can make money, but I hope they will buy this book and form conversations in their church. You know, this may not be Sunday morning Sunday school class, but it could be a small group in your church that really needs to talk about this. And I think Dennis and I would try to help people answer their questions as they have them. And I know that Dennis continues to write at the BioLogos website, trying to speak to lay people about these difficult issues. So that's what I hope happens.
Great. Thanks, Scott. So just to let you know, if you'd like to pre-order this book, I'd really encourage you to get on Amazon and to do that. And I'll have that link in the description below for this episode. But thanks again for joining us as we discuss how the kingdom took root then and how it's taking root now.